Milos playing Tárrega's Adelita, closing in tune for today. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, where it's time now to go over to the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's live prom. It's presented by Andrew McGregor.
Birmingham's favourite Latvian brings Leningrad to London. That could be the headline for this evening's prom. Andris Nelsons, still only in his mid-30s, really has made the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra his own in his four seasons as music director. Not just at home in Symphony Hall, but here at the proms, in European festivals, in Berlin and Lucerne, and with their acclaimed recordings of Tchaikovsky and Richard Strauss. Nelsons himself will be telling us why he thinks Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony is a masterpiece before we hear it in the second half of the concert. The Seventh Symphony Shostakovich composed in a city under siege in the early 1940s, working on the score between trips to the air raid shelter as German aircraft bombarded the city. This was the score smuggled out of Leningrad on microfilm and given its Western premiere here at the proms in June 1942, conducted by Sir Henry Wood. So Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony is a serious part of proms history. We have a UK premiere in the first half of the prom, which takes us on a neurological journey through a sequence of memories. It's Liverpudlian composer Emily Howard's Calculus of the Nervous System. And Emily is a former chess champion and a maths and computing graduate, so it's easy to see why she was inspired by Lord Byron's daughter, Ada, a pioneering mathematician. Emily will be telling us herself how Ada's ideas became music before we hear her new piece. But to begin the CBSO's prom, they've brought with them a scintillating Russian showpiece, Mikhail Glinka's overture for his opera Ruslan and Lyudmila. Princess Lyudmila is betrothed to the heroic Russian in Glinka's second opera, but she's caught the eye of an evil sorcerer whose monsters abduct Lyudmila during the wedding feast, and the rest of the opera concerns Ruslan's attempts to rescue his princess. And that applause is for the CBSO's leader, Lawrence Jackson. And Ruslan, by the way, defeats the sorcerer by cutting off his beard, the source of his magical powers. And for many people, Glinka's opera in 1842 was a landmark in Russian music, establishing a kind of national style that was a rich source for other composers. And here to conduct them in the overture to Glinka's opera is the CBSO's music director, Andris Nelsons.
Thank you.
The overture to Glinka's Ruslan and Lyudmila, which Glinka composed pretty hurriedly apparently while the rest of the opera was already in rehearsal. A famous orchestral showpiece dispatched with appropriately muscular vigour by the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra and its Latvian conductor Andris Nelsons, whose boyish enthusiasm on the podium is obviously infectious. Well, after mentioning muscles, it's actually the central nervous system that concerns us in the piece we're about to hear, the UK premiere of Emily Howard's Calculus of the Nervous System, a title which needs a little unpicking, I think, so who better to do it for us than the composer herself? I caught up with Emily during this afternoon's rehearsals to ask about the woman who inspired her.
I'm interested in Ada Lovelace. She was a mathematician and daughter of Lord Byron as well. She worked on the analytical engine by Charles Babbage, but she also had so many other wonderful ideas, one of them being that she wanted to create a calculus of the nervous system. And by that, she meant a mathematical model for how the brain might give rise to thought and nerves to feelings. The structure of the piece is such that I wouldn't call it predictable. I think it keeps travelling to different places like a brain might. It's a bit like a sequence of memories. And I was also thinking about how the brain might be, you know, in a minimally conscious state.
You've also used the poetry of Geoffrey Hill as part of your inspiration, and the score is actually littered with these little quotations from some of his stanzas.
I was reading Clavix last year. There were so many things in it, some of the lines, chaos or chess, which really appealed to me. I used to play chess a lot as a child. But when I was writing it, some of these memories were also, if you like, connected to these lines from the poetry. So I left them in the score rather like instructions.
Composer Emily Howard, and just to give you an example of some of those instructions, truth is austere, consilience and neurocratic hope. Chaos or chess, all lines from Geoffrey Hill's Clavix quoted in the score. It was published last year and the collection's epigraph gives an imaginary Oxford English Dictionary entry for the made-up word Clavix, the science or alchemy of keys. And keys can be understood in literary, explanatory or musical form. And the poetry is largely inspired by a composer, William Laws, who was killed during the Siege of Chester in 1645. And here to conduct Calculus of the Nervous System by Emily Howard is Andris Nelsons.
Thank you.
Calculus of the Nervous System by Emily Howard. You just heard the first UK performance here at the BBC Proms with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andris Nelsons. The orchestra is standing the back of the first violins, moving their chairs to allow Emily onto the platform, shaking hands with Andris Nelsons and leader Lawrence Jackson, and bowing to the promenaders in front of her in the arena and everybody around the hall, applauding conductor and orchestra for that performance. It was actually commissioned by the Wien Modern Festival as part of the festival's composer focus on Emily's music, first performance last November, conducted by James McMillan in Vienna. And it's one of Emily Howard's Lovelace trilogy, alongside the dramatic vocal work Ada Sketches and Mesmerism for piano and chamber orchestra. And she told me earlier she's also thinking about an opera on Ada Lovelace, really getting maximum musical value for money from her fellow mathematician. Well, Emily Howard's new piece linked us to one of the major sieges in British history 4 centuries ago, when the city of Chester fell as its population was starved over the course of a year. In Soviet Russia, almost exactly 3 centuries later, the German army laid siege to Leningrad, and the city became a symbol of Russian defiance. And so did Dmitri Shostakovich's 7th Symphony, written with the Germans camped outside the gates, a requiem for the many hundreds of thousands who died, and an eloquent testament to the terrors of totalitarianism, perhaps as much at home as abroad. Andris Nelsons conducts Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony in the second half of this evening's prom. And don't forget that you'll find full details of the concert on the prom's website, and you can also listen online in HD sound. Well, now it's time to join Ian McMillan and his guests for this evening's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier at the Royal College of Music across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Welcome to this evening's literary prom, and I'm glad that our hall here at the Royal College of Music isn't vast and gloomy, because tonight we're celebrating Russian literature, which is often seen as being vast and gloomy. Well, to be honest, sometimes it is vast and gloomy. Our guides through the steppes, the samovar houses, and the endless slow train journeys full of stout men and women in fur hats are the novelist Pat Barker and the Church of England priest Giles Fraser. Pat Barker is perhaps best known for a regeneration trilogy, which takes an epic and yet deeply personal sweep across the First World War. I love her early book, Union Street, stories about women like my mam and my auntie Mabel, the kinds of women who didn't often get written about in books. Giles Fraser is a priest who gets deeply involved in the world. He is, I believe, one of the few people who's written for The Guardian, The Daily Mail and The Socialist Worker. He resigned his post as Canon Chancellor of St Paul's Cathedral last October because of the authorities' response to the Occupy protesters. He's currently priest in charge of St Mary's Church, Newington, in South London. And our extracts are going to be read by Melanie Gray. Please welcome them all. So we're talking about Russian literature tonight, and I know you've both chosen huge, towering classics of Russian literature. Tolstoy's War and Peace and Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov are the novels of vast scope and ambition, but ultimately, of course, about people. And it seems to me that both authors and priests need that same patience with human complexity. Pat, do you think that's the case?
I think priests probably need patience. I think what novelists need is delight in human complexity. It is, after all, the way in which we earn our living.
But there's also has to be a bit of patience while the characters work their way through, I guess.
Certainly the patience is required when you first start writing about a character and you're trying to establish the voice. And sometimes that comes quickly and easily, and sometimes it takes months and months, and the waste paper basket gets fuller and fuller.
And at that time, it's patience with yourself, I guess, as well as the character.
Oh, with the process. Patience with the process, I think. It can't be hurried.
And what about you, Giles?
Well, it's true. A good priest needs patience, which is probably why I'm not a very good priest, because I'm a terribly impatient thing. It's very difficult. You must listen. You must be someone who's able to listen. And some people listen by being quiet and letting the other person speak, and some people listen by being in some sort of conversation with them and so forth. And I guess I justify my impatience as a different form of listening, as a way of listening through conversation, but I'm a terribly impatient person. But it's absolutely true that the complexity of the world is our business. I mean, one of the great things about being a priest, wearing a dog collar, which I don't do very often, is it's an access all areas pass. I mean, you can sort of go anywhere with a dog collar, and you actually really do get to see the world in all its complexity. It's a huge privilege to do that.
Now, you've chosen an extract from The Brothers Karamazov. Now, D.H. Lawrence hated this book. He said it made his heart sink. So why do you love it?
Well, it's not a book to love. It's a wonderfully brave book about the human condition and about faith. And what I particularly love is how brave Dostoevsky is because he gives... He's so sort of porous, so open, so non-defenseless to what's going on in the world that he's prepared to give the best arguments in the book to the people he disagrees with. And I think that's the most extraordinary thing. So, you know, one of the passages that we're going to hear from in a minute is Ivan Karamazov, and it's a sort of condemnation of the church and of Christianity. And yet, and he gets the best arguments in the book, and yet that's not Dostoevsky at all.
So could you introduce the bit that we're about here? What's just happened?
Yes, I mean, this is one of the most terrifying passages in literature. Christ returns in the middle of the Inquisition, and the Grand Inquisitor, this ancient priest, comes out, finds Christ on the steps of the cathedral, has just raised a small child to life. And then what happens? You'd expect the great bishop to celebrate him and welcome him. He arrests him, and then this is what happens.
All right, let's hear it. Our reader is Melanie Gray.
In the pitch darkness, the iron door of the prison is suddenly opened, and the Grand Inquisitor himself comes in with a light in his hand. He is alone. The door is closed at once behind him. He stands in the doorway, and for a minute or two gazes into his face. At last, he goes up slowly, sets the light on the table, and speaks. Is it you? You. But receiving no answer, he adds at once, Don't answer. Be silent. What can you say, indeed? I know too well what you would say, and you have no right to add anything to what you said of old. Why then are you come to hinder us? For you have come to hinder us, and you know that. But do you know what will be tomorrow? I know not who you are, and care not to know whether it is you or only a semblance of him, but tomorrow I shall condemn you and burn you at the stake as the worst of heretics. And the very people who have today kissed your feet, tomorrow at the faintest sign from me will rush to heap up the embers of your fire. Know you that? Yes, maybe you know it. For if anyone has ever deserved our fires, it is you. Tomorrow I shall burn you. When the Inquisitor ceased speaking, he waited some time for the prisoner to answer him. His silence weighed down upon him. He saw that the prisoner had listened intently all the time, looking gently in his face and evidently not wishing to reply. The old man longed for him to say something, however bitter and terrible. But he suddenly approached the old man in silence and softly kissed him on his bloodless, aged lips. That was all his answer. The old man shuddered. His lips moved. He went to the door, opened it, and said to him, Go, and come no more. Come not at all, never, never. And he let him out into the dark alleys of the town. The prisoner went away. And the old man? The kiss glows in his heart, but the old man adheres to his idea.
Thank you very much. Now, Giles, one of the brothers is religious, one's a sceptic. How do you find yourself responding to their religious debates?
Well, it's not even a debate. I mean, Alyosha, who's the religious one, doesn't have very good arguments. He's not as clever as the rationalist one. And yet what Dostoevsky, I think, is trying to do here is trying to say, you know, he has a real problem with rationalism. Mm. And he's saying, yeah, the arguments are really great, that the chapter before this one is another chapter called Rebellion, about the problem of evil, the problem of suffering children. So all these arguments are absolutely right. And all he has to counter it is this sort of simple novice monk and a kiss, and the idea that that's his argument. Mm. And for me, it's absolutely extraordinary. And Dostoevsky is so non-defensive about his his faith and where he is. I mean, he even says at one point, if the truth is on one side and Christ is on the other, I go with Christ and not the truth. Now, I mean, that sounds madness, absolute madness. You know, I just go with that kiss, which warms the heart. And, I mean, the other religious figure in it, Zosima, I mean, he's really dull. You know, I mean, he's not... These aren't... You know, the salvation doesn't come through the church or churchy people or the best arguments, but there's this kiss which just won't go away. And, what's terrifying about that passage, absolutely terrifying, is the church... You know, this is... Ivan is telling this story, the rationalist, and he's saying the church sometimes... often betrays Christianity. Christ is too Christian. He lets people have freedom, and the church is against Christ. And, you know, Dostoevsky knows that's sometimes right.
And Pat, how do you respond to this novel?
I'm quite interested in the fact that both Aloysia, that's the religious young monk, and Ivan are actually in a very precarious situation. With regard to their respective faiths. Aloysia seems to think that when his elder, Zosimo, whom he really reveres, dies, a miracle is expected, and the miracle is that Zosimo's body will not decay, rather like the body of St. Cuthbert, if you come from Durham. But in fact, what happens is quite contrary to that. The body putrefies with extraordinary rapidity. The cell stinks in no time at all. And Aloysia is actually deeply troubled by that. But Ivan, too, is in almost the same situation because he tells these terrible, terrible stories about the torture of children, which I can hardly bear to read. And all he really has to oppose to that is the fact that every spring he feels the sticky green leaves and he knows he loves life. But we know that actually, as a young man, that is a complete answer. It's animal high spirits. But as an old man, that is not going to be enough. And neither of their faiths actually is tenable.
Can I ask you whether you feel that nationality has a part to play in reading novels like this? Is our response inevitably non-Russian, or does it transcend that kind of nationality, do you think?
It's virtually impossible to... imagine three Englishmen going on in quite this way. Mm. Yeah, I think it is peculiarly Russian. What interests me is in the communist period, how did a communist read all this? I think that's much more of a barrier than not being Russian.
What about you, Giles? We're not Russian, so we have to respond to it in a different way, don't we?
Yes, I was actually talking to a friend of mine who speaks Russian, who's a Russianist this afternoon, and he was saying about the difference between Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. With Tolstoy, the art, the language is so important that when you read him in Russian in translation, you get so much more. With Dostoevsky, he says, actually he's painting with a sort of very broad brush. It's ideas, it's sort of characters, it's big pictures. And so he was saying he thought you don't need as much Russian to get Dostoevsky as you do to get Tolstoy. And that sort of made sense to me, because Tolstoy is about the characters rather than the sort of aesthetics of the language.
True, because, Pat, you've chosen War and Peace as your extract.
Yes, I have.
And it is epic writing. Did it influence when you were writing Regeneration, that trilogy?
Not consciously, but I read it very early, and if you read a book early, it probably does have an unconscious influence. I mean, when I wrote Regeneration, I used real characters, historical characters and fictional characters together, and I used to be asked at the time, are you writing faction? And I used to say, well, only in the sense that Shakespeare and Tolstoy were writing faction, not that I would mention my own work in the same breath as either of them. But it is important to realise that the rules are there to be broken, essentially. The passage I've chosen is one where Tolstoy does use a fictional character and brings him face to face with a real character, Napoleon Bonaparte. And the fictional character is called Prince Andrei. And Napoleon, as the great reformer of France, has always been Prince Andrei's hero.
All right, well, let's hear the extract.
Prince Andrei, who had been thrust forward under the emperor's eyes to complete the array of prisoners, could not fail to attract his attention. Napoleon apparently remembered seeing him on the battlefield, and addressing him, he used the same epithet, jeune homme, with which his first sight of Bolkonski was associated in his memory. "Well, and you, young man," said he, "how do you feel, mon brave?" Although 5 minutes previously Prince Andrei had been able to say a few words to the soldiers who were carrying him, now, with his eyes fixed steadily on Napoleon, he was silent. So trivial seemed to him at that moment all the interests that engrossed Napoleon, so petty did his hero, with his paltry vanity and delight in victory, appear compared to that lofty, righteous, and kindly sky which he had seen and comprehended, that he could not answer him. Everything did, indeed, seem so futile and insignificant in comparison with the stern and solemn train of thought induced in him by his lapsing consciousness, as his lifeblood ebbed away, but his suffering and the nearness of death. Gazing into Napoleon's eyes, Prince Andrei mused on the unimportance of greatness, the unimportance of life which no one could understand, and the still greater unimportance of death, the meaning of which no one alive could understand or explain. The emperor, after pausing in vain for an answer, turned away and said to one of the officers as he moved on, "See that these gentlemen are looked after and taken to my bivouac. Let my surgeon, Dr. Leray, attend to their wounds. Au revoir, Prince Repnin." And he spurred his horse and galloped away. His face was radiant with happiness and self-satisfaction.
So part, War and Peace is partly about that relationship between huge events and individuals and how the two mesh together. And the book has a kind of philosophical angle on that as well, doesn't it?
Well, yes. Yeah. When Tolstoy was researching the book, he read every history of the 1812 invasion, both in Russian and in French, and he wasn't very impressed by them, actually, because they all emphasised the overriding importance of great men. And Tolstoy believed that great men were of very superficial importance and that their power was often illusory. And he believed that the great change in history is driven by myriads and myriads of ordinary people doing apparently quite insignificant things. And, you know, part of his... all of his ambition in War and Peace was to give a sense of that swarm of humanity taking these tiny little decisions, often in ignorance of what was happening, and how those tiny little decisions come together and produce radical change.
It's funny, though, isn't it, as well, that we tend to associate this kind of novel with 19th century writers. But I don't think that's correct, because you think contemporary novels can be and are as ambitious. Think of things like A Suitable Boy or Midnight's Children or your trilogy. So somehow we can be as ambitious, can't we, in the 20th and 21st centuries?
Yes, and I think... I don't know whether Tolstoy is being very daring and breaking the rules. I think perhaps he was making the rules as he went along, as a, you know, a genius of that stature can do.
Do you think this is the point where it's difficult for us as non-Russians to get something? Because all that love that you have in lots of Russian literature with the peasantry,
yes,
and, you know, living close to the land and all that stuff about, I mean, even that stuff about nature, I mean, why he likes peasants, is there a part of, and you get this, this is a sort of conversion experience, isn't it, that we have in this reading. And part of the conversion is that he suddenly sees the sky, feels a part of the nature of things. And there's something about that you get here, the Russian soul is close to, through the peasantry, is close to nature. There's something there that, I guess, I live in the Elephant and Castle, so it
yes,
just, it isn't something that really, it doesn't really sort of grip me. But there's something there I see as quite distinctive.
I would certainly agree with that. I can't think of any English novel. Adam Bede, perhaps, would be the closest, where there's the same sense of it being beneficial to get in touch with the common people. I don't think it's something we have, but then we didn't have a system of slavery, which, of course, at this stage, they still did. It had been only recently been abolished when Tolstoy was writing the novel.
And we don't only read them through the prism of history, we also read them through a kind of fog, if you like, of translation. And what do you think we're missing by not reading them in the right way?
I would need to speak Russian to know what we were missing. I mean, I think you always know when you're reading poetry that you're probably missing at least 80 or 90% of what the poet originally wrote. But I think in novels it's quite difficult to know what you're missing, and I think it probably varies very much from novelist to novelist.
And you also get, I mean, the other difference that separates us from both of these authors is something about the Russian Orthodox Church, the importance of faith to these people, that things like icons for Dostoevsky, for the church, how that sort of bleeds into nationalism. That is something that when we're reading it now, especially in sort of secular 21st century, that really puts many people at a distance from this. They can't see what all the fuss is about, why it's such a drama. And yet for them, it is, in a different way, life and death stuff. I mean, Tolstoy wants to... I always think of Tolstoy as a bit of a rationalist. He wants to sort of get some sort of order handle on everything. Dostoevsky is much happier to let things go, but they're still responding to a similar sort of problematic, I guess.
I think that is also part of the Victorian experience in England, though. This sense that if there isn't a God and there isn't immortality, then there is no reason for anybody to live a moral life. But then, as George Eliot said, there is no God, and yet we must be good. But, you know, you don't have to agree with her.
So, very briefly, then, at the end, these are seen as difficult books. People are put off by the vastness of them. They're tough to finish. Can I ask each of you for your advice to a beginner, Charles? If you're starting off, where what would you begin with?
Well, I've got to tell you, I'm a terrible reader. I'm a really terrible reader. And so I really am... I mean, I have to tell this terrible secret, I'm on the radio, but I've just bribed my daughter with cash money to read Anna Karenina. So I just wanted to go and read it. So there's, but once you just immerse yourself in it, for me, the reading is actually quite difficult. But the ideas that flow out of it, they last a lifetime.
All right, and Pat, would you offer money?
Well, no, but I'm going to say something even more shocking. When you're dealing with something of the size of War and Peace or The Brothers Karamazov, why not buy yourself some of these lovely little Cliff Notes or Sparks Notes, which people use as crammers when they're working for an exam? Simply because they will give you the lines of the story. And it's certainly not a substitute for actually reading and immersing yourself in the work, but they do act as a kind of map.
I used to love those. Classics Illustrated. Yes. Remember them? Little comics. War and Peace in 16 pages. Thank you very much to my guests, Giles Fraser and Pat Barker, and to our reader, Melanie Gray. We've been discussing The Brothers Karamazov and War and Peace, which I hope you'll all go off and read before tomorrow. Thank you very much.
It's going to take longer than that. Ian McMillan presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event, and the producer was Laura Thomas. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. I'm Andrew McGregor, live at the Royal Albert Hall, where we're about to hear the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra reliving the Siege of Leningrad in a performance of Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, his Leningrad Symphony, conducted by Andris Nelsons. And we'll hear what the orchestra's Latvian music director thinks of the piece in a moment or two, but I'm joined right now in the presentation box by the orchestra's chief executive, Stephen Madigan. Stephen, we're four seasons into Andris Nelsons' stewardship of the orchestra, and there's still a real buzz about the partnership. How would you say they've changed, evolved over the last 4 years?
Well, I think, of course, orchestras have to continue to evolve to survive. For us, that's been a lot of it has been to do with the repertoire we play. So these big Russian and German pieces, a lot of opera, a lot of Wagner, which is one of Andris's passions. We played the complete Tristan and Isolde earlier this year, which is the first time the orchestra had ever played it. That was an amazing experience, you know, life-changing thing for people.
It's such a thrill for symphony orchestras to get their teeth into that kind of repertoire.
Fantastic.
They just don't get it the rest of the time.
Absolutely. We're doing The Flying Dutchman next year. So opera has been a strong thing, and because Andris is such a great opera conductor, but also it's about the way of playing, and you'll hear in this Shostakovich there's just a kind of no holds barred, no prisoners way of conducting, which takes a little while to adjust to for new orchestras, but now is just so thrilling for us that every performance feels like an event.
Well, they're coming onto the stage as we're talking. Just very, very briefly, I know it's a really busy summer. Where are you heading next?
Well, the next thing for us is Edinburgh Festival next week for Sibelius 2 and Goodbye Dulina, and then a four-concert residency at the Lucerne Festival in Switzerland. So, again, big pieces, Mahler 2, Beethoven 9 and Shostakovich. So, great honour for us to be there for a residency and very exciting place to be.
Stephen, thanks very much for joining us. It's great to have you all back at the BBC Proms. Well, let's find out right away exactly why this dynamic young conductor liked Shostakovich so much, and especially his Seventh Symphony.
everything he writes is a genius work, whether he writes for films, theatre, for string quartet, for symphony orchestra or opera. In my feeling, I would call him Russian Mozart, you know, because everything Mozart wrote was really a masterpiece. And I think the same with Shostakovich. Any piece you take, it's a masterpiece. And therefore, it shows to me that we sometimes over-politicize his music. It is also a music just genius by itself, even if there was no war. And this is one of these victory pieces where it ends so powerful that there is no chance that Hitler would have won the war. I mean, after hearing this symphony.
Andrus Nelson's. As far as I know, Hitler didn't hear the Leningrad Symphony, but some of his soldiers certainly did, as it was broadcast to them on loudspeakers from the besieged city itself. But Shostakovich wrote in his original programme, though, that he hadn't composed so-called battle music. He wanted to convey the content of terrifying events, which he does after the first movement's opening theme with the so-called invasion theme that begins with the rattle of the solo snare drum and builds inexorably, a march using musical ideas from Shostakovich's own opera, Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, and from Lear's operetta, The Merry Widow, which is reputed to have been one of Hitler's favourites. Shostakovich calls the central part of the first movement a requiem for the heroes who died for us. The symphony's two middle movements originally carried the titles Memories and The Homeland's Vistas, and the finale ultimately delivers the triumphant return of the symphony's opening theme, battered but unbroken. And to transport us to the siege of Leningrad in 1941, here's Andrus Nelson's to conduct the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra in Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony.
Thank you. Thank you.
A triumphant C major ending to Dmitri Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony. Well, if it is at all, it's desperately hard won. Shostakovich capturing that combination of hope, despair, and grim determination that he felt in one of the longest sieges in history and perhaps the most destructive. You've just heard Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony, performed by the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by its music director, Andris Nelsons, and greeted by a proper proms roar. Here he comes back to the platform. Asking some of the members of the orchestra to stand for their individual calls. Piccolo player Andrew Lane, flautist Mary Christine Zupacic, clarinetist Nicholas Carpenter. We shouldn't forget the little shrill E-flat clarinet, one of Shostakovich's favourite, one of the secrets of that wind sound in so much of his music, played by Joanna Patton. And the bass clarinetist Mark O'Brien standing there, providing that deeply satisfying solo in the second movement of the symphony. Bassoonist Greta Tulls, the horn section. We've got two horn sections, in fact. We shouldn't miss pointing out that Shostakovich actually has two separate brass sections, one in the conventional position over to the right behind the winds, the others high up behind the percussionists. Stage left, just standing, all of them, that second brass group, to take their own bow. And that roar, of course, is for the solo snare drum player, Adrian Spilett, from the seven-strong percussion section, three of them playing snare drums in the Invasion March section. The harpists and orchestral pianists getting their turn in the spotlight. I think everybody's going to be taken one at a time and given their own share of the limelight, the timpanist now. And we shouldn't forget the CBSO's leader, Lawrence Jackson, for his solos, the strings standing now. And I mentioned that a performance was broadcast to the Germans besieging the city of Leningrad. They actually managed to mount that performance with the last remaining emaciated musicians of the city's radio orchestra, just 14 or 15 of them who haven't been evacuated or sent to the front. They were joined by musicians from the trenches, and they managed to broadcast it on loudspeakers around the city in August 1942, and they made sure that the Germans fell silent during the performance by ordering a bombardment of German artillery positions before the performance. Well, that was actually after it was given its first performance in the West in June that year with Sir Henry Wood at the Proms. Andris Nelsons back on stage, and they're going to be back home in Birmingham on Thursday in Symphony Hall for a concert of choral music by Brahms and Beethoven. They've already recorded the Seventh Symphony, by the way, so keep your eyes and ears open for it on CD. And you don't have to wait long for your next Shostakovich Symphony here at the Proms, his 10th on Thursday from the Royal Liverpool Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Vasily Petrenko. I'll be presenting that one, so I very much hope you'll join me here in the Royal Albert Hall in 2 days' time, live here on BBC Radio 3, of course, the home of the Proms. Where this evening, as the CBSO stands to roars from the promenaders, we've enjoyed two pieces written 60 years apart, each in its own way, connected to sieges 3 centuries apart. Well, here at the hall, we're free to leave, but locked into Broadcasting House for the evening is Ian Skelly.
Happily so, I must say. Andrew, thank you very much indeed. That was Andrew McGregor at the Royal Albert Hall for us tonight. Always very special to hear that symphony at the Proms, making history every time it's played, it seems. Well, there's a chance to hear the whole of that concert if you missed some of it on Monday the 3rd of September during Afternoon on 3. That begins at 2 o'clock. Or, of course, you can listen to it on the Radio 3 website, where you'll also find a fascinating conversation with Andris Nelsons, which made up this week's Lebrecht interview, last night, in fact. Extraordinary journey he's made so far in such a short space of time. Birmingham is very lucky indeed that he's just renewed his contract with the CBSO. Well, tomorrow night we have two proms for you. The first is given by the London Symphony Orchestra and conducted by Valery Gergiev, a powerful advocate of the work that you'll hear tomorrow night. You may have heard him talking passionately about it on In Tune this evening, which is also something available to listen to again on the Radio 3 website and very much worth listening to if you didn't catch that conversation. The music is by Prokofiev. It's his ballet Cinderella, and we're going to be live at the Royal Albert Hall at 7 tomorrow night for that concert. Then we'll be back there at 10:15 for a late-night prom. I Fagiolini celebrates music that is roughly 400 years old by a variety of early Italian composers, among them Gabrielli, Monteverdi, Viadana and Bassano. That's a late prom tomorrow night, live here on Radio 3 at 10:15. Well, we have more live music to come tonight on Radio 3, not from South Ken, but from the heart of the Edinburgh International Festival. Late Junction will be coming live from Edinburgh tonight, and you can hear performances by the Mercury Prize nominee King Creosote and classical guitar music performed by John Etheridge. Much more besides two, all from 11 o'clock tonight here on Radio 3. And in the meantime, we're going to head to China. Isabel Hilton will be your guide around the many brand new museums in China. There's a big boom in museum building, apparently, sparked by a growing interest in contemporary history. Between 8 and 10 million artefacts from China's recent past are going on display. What sort of things are they, though, and why are they suddenly so attractive to visitors? You can find out at 10 tonight. To take us there, we have more music. I've a recording of Gergiev in just a moment, conducting one of his other great passions, Wagner. But first, to soothe the mood after such a monumental orchestral climax, something a little softer from Schubert. A Fugue by Schubert, music for two pianists, who were, in that case, Paul Lewis and Stephen Osborne. As I mentioned, tomorrow night's first prom is given by Valery Gergiev, conducting the London Symphony Orchestra, conducting the ballet score to Prokofiev's Cinderella. Well, by way of a prelude to that, I thought we could hear him conducting a prelude now, not to a piece by Prokofiev, but by Wagner. This is the prelude to Wagner's last epic music drama, completed not long before he died in 1883. Gergiev is conducting the orchestra of the Mariinsky Theatre in this live recording of Parsifal. The prelude to Parsifal by Wagner, played by the Mariinsky Theatre Orchestra, conducted by the man in charge of the LSO tomorrow night at the Proms, Valery Gergiev. Prokofiev's Cinderella, live here on Radio 3, tomorrow night at 7.
On Radio 3, Bank Holiday Monday at the BBC Proms. At 1 o'clock, Christina Schaefer performs Schoenberg's Pierrot Lunaire. At 3, a journey to the far corners of our musical world with the gospel vocal group Blind Boys of Alabama. Amazing grace. And at 8 o'clock, Prom's favourite John Wilson recreates the Broadway sound with the help of his hand-picked high-octane orchestra. A packed Bank Holiday Monday at the BBC Proms. Hear it all live on BBC Radio 3 from 1 o'clock.
It's 10 o'clock now and time for the first of two features on Radio 3 this week that take us to China. As the country continues its dramatic modernisation, Isabel Hilton reports on the changing ways that history is being presented and used in China's museum building boom.
A sentimental ballad performed by Fan Jianchuan, former soldier, one-time mayor, property developer, and now founder and proprietor of the world's largest private museum complex. Mr. Fan does nothing by halves. He's wearing military camouflage trousers and combat boots, and his chauffeur is driving us on a whistle-stop tour of his first 15 museums. He's playing me his own CD, a kind of Desert Island Discs, with Mr. Fan singing all the songs and playing all the parts. It would take at least 2 days to get around Mr. Fan's museums properly. We stopped briefly at the Footbinder Museum, the Anti-Japanese War Museum, an astonishing building containing only clocks and several devoted to the Cultural Revolution. I've looked into the vast warehouse where millions more objects and documents are waiting to be sorted, catalogued and displayed in the next wave of museums, planned for this huge ex-military base in rural China. Fan Jianchuan is a whirlwind of museum creation, but he's also straining at the limits of what can be said about some of the darkest times in China's recent past. He's trying to tell China's terrible 20th century as he sees it, rather than reading a government script. His museum complex would be extraordinary anywhere. In China, Fan Jianchuan is charting a new path in the public exploration of history. In this programme, we look at how history is used in China, the changing relationship with the past, and how the Communist Party wants its people to understand the contentious events of the 20th century. What is the party's relationship now with China's long and complex history? And can private efforts like Mr. Fan's really influence the way China sees itself? This, after all, is a country in which museums have traditionally had a very clear story to tell. Not so long ago, the place I'm standing in would have been what you might expect to find looking for history and the way it's presented in China. It's a museum, but one with a message. It's the mansion of the wealthy Liu family in the countryside in Sichuan province, and in one of its 27 courtyards stands one of the most iconic artworks of Chairman Mao's most radical years, a series of life-sized clay statues depicting the cruelty and exploitation of the Chinese peasant by the wicked landlords. This is Rent Collection Courtyard, created in 1966, a year before the Cultural Revolution, to put a revolutionary stamp on this historic mansion. But history in China is a moving target, loud in some places, full of silences in others. Today, China wants to forget the radical years, and there's something missing from Rent Collection Courtyard. In 1970, a further set of clay figures was placed in the courtyard next door to tell how the Communist Party captured the landlord and led the peasants to revolution. It was never quite true. This particular landlord died before the communists arrived, and today the statues are gone. A notice on the wall says they were damaged by natural causes. All that's left is a rising tide of red flags on one wall and a picture of Chairman Mao. In China, as Chairman Mao once put it, history must serve the present.
We want our students to know that in modern China, the major goals of our ancestors is to build a strong democratic country.
Beijing history professor Wang Xianming explains how history is taught to today's students in China.
We have no more emperors, we have new governments, we have a new state, and science and technology became more and more important in daily life.
So history still has a message, but today it's no longer the triumphant march from oppression to communist liberation, but the ambition to build a strong, modern and technologically advanced China. In Chairman Mao's time, his story dominated the presentation of history to the exclusion of almost everyone else. But now, according to Wang Hui, one of China's most influential historians, even Mao's old Nationalist Party rival is being given some credit.
The past for China is always the field for the arguments. Like sometimes Mao was the great hero, but now the people also try to retrieve the history of Chiang Kai-shek. All these different kind of the peoples that became the topic in the contemporary context.
At first glance, then, China's history is much more open as a result of the last 30 years of economic reform and opening up to the world. In many ways, it seems like the West, historians getting to grips with the present through an open-minded exploration of the past. But scratch the surface a little, and it looks very different. Many academics and historians seem afraid to discuss the no-go areas, the limits to their research that are set by the government's official narrative of Chinese history. It's a field that still seems to provoke anxiety. Stepping over some invisible line, according to the journalist Lin Gu, or even discussing openly where the line might be, can get historians and newspaper editors into trouble.
If you meet up with people working inside the system, obviously, for fear of losing their jobs, the yearning to secure their position and even climb up higher, they would choose silence as a convenient tactic to protect themselves.
In one notorious case, a newspaper editor was sacked for publishing an article on the 1900 Boxer Rebellion, the revolt against the growing foreign presence in China that's conventionally taught as a patriotic and heroic movement. The history professor who wrote the article took a different view, seeing it as both anti-Confucian and anti-Chinese. Chao Mu, professor of international media studies, explains that despite China's economic reforms, the government's tight control of the media ensures that public discussion of history stays well within the bounds the Communist Party sets.
You know, this year, or last year, is the 30th anniversary of Chinese opening up and reform. You can find many other industries field have been opened for the private and foreign investment. Only the media didn't open, still tightly controlled by the government or the party, the propaganda department of party.
So does that mean that even discussing history in the media or in universities is also tightly controlled by the propaganda department?
I think orally, you can discuss everything, even sometimes on the internet, in the cyber world. But if you want to print something, you have to be censored.
The well-known anthropologist Jing Jun from Tsinghua University knows this well. His book on the politics of memory in rural China has been banned for more than a decade. He thinks history is poorly taught in China today. But first, David Kelly, visiting professor at the University of Beijing.
The history of the 20th century is the big blank. And this was, of course, one of the major criticisms made of the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games, which is a tableau, was a tableau of the sweep of the 5,000 years of history. It had almost nothing to say about the 20th century. You can't use the 20th century as a representative culture. Representative culture in the sense of the things that you like to bring out and put on the table and say, this is us. Please look upon our works and take it seriously.
I don't think history is taught enough in our school system. Our school system is geared towards examination. So the history is taught in a formula. There will be the right answer, and there will be standard questions. So history is taught in my country in such a simplistic manner. So the appreciation of history has to start once you graduate from high school. probably once you come to colleges, universities like mine.
The art of censorship, though, is to keep it discreet. There may still be a strong party line, but officially history is an open field. There may not yet be an official history of the Communist Party itself, but according to the director of the China National Association of International Studies, Victor Gao, some previously banned subjects, including the Cultural Revolution, can now be discussed. As for current taboos, he says, there are very few, and everyone knows what they are.
Let me tell you what are the taboos here in China, if there are. One is the Taiwan independence. The Chinese government will not tolerate anyone talking about that. One is Tibetan independence, or the Uyghur, the Xinjiang independence. And on top of that, you know, they will not tolerate overthrowing the current-day government and the ruling party in China, either by force or by propaganda, or by whatever they consider to be undermining the what they call domestic stability and security. Falun Gong is another taboo, but other than that, you know, I think the society is becoming more and more transparent, and talking about these things themselves should not be a problem. I think there are lots of books which are now being published about the 50s, the Great Cultural Revolution, and the early part of the 1970s, etc.
This is one of Beijing's biggest bookshops on the south end of Wangfujing, Beijing's big wide shopping street, and it goes over three floors. It's quite enormous. But curiously, the modern history section seems to consist of just a few shelves tucked away on the ground floor. And it's quite an interesting collection. It's not that there aren't books, but somehow, as you're, if you're interested in something in particular and you take a book out to try to find it, it's often not there. I'm looking, for instance, there's a very impressive set of bound volumes of the history of China from 1950, 1951. This seems to go by year, but it stops in 1955. So the Great Leap Forward, obviously the Cultural Revolution, none of that is there. Then almost next to it on the shelf, there's a history of 60 years of the new China. I've had a look through that. And again, there are big absences. In fact, Chairman Mao only gets one picture that I could find. I have in my hand a history of Tiananmen Square from 1949 to 2009. This is quite interesting because it does have the Cultural Revolution. There's a famous picture of a Red Guard pinning a Red Guard armband on Chairman Mao in Tiananmen on the top of the gate. But if I go to 1989, again, I hit the silence. 1989 in Tiananmen Square, apparently the most significant things were that George Bush was there in February, and then in September there was a commemoration of the 40th anniversary for the People's Republic. Nothing in between. So the huge events of May and June in Tiananmen Square are just not here.
People don't want to look at the Cultural Revolution. It is the thing which is not there. It's not just the Cultural Revolution, going back to the Great Leap. From the Great Leap through the Cultural Revolution, it's the thing that didn't happen. People are more concerned, the story is more concerned with what didn't happen. We didn't go down in flames. We didn't lose control of the country.
In China, you can touch something we call social problem, but you cannot touch some political problem. You can say something like poverty, AIDS, HIV, no problem, for education problem, but you cannot say the political system, the communist rule of the party is wrong or got some problem.
One effect of these silences is that a student of the official history of China is encouraged to believe that all the bad things that happened were the fault of foreigners, especially the Japanese, and credit for all the good things can be claimed by the Communist Party. The terrible results of some Communist Party policies, especially in the first decades of the People's Republic, are simply not acknowledged. Take China's greatest modern secret, for example, the death of some 30 million people in the early 60s as a result of the famine brought about by the Great Leap Forward. Some people at the time were so desperate they turned to cannibalism. But this is still coyly described in the textbooks as 3 years of natural disaster.
We still know it's got a term called the 3 years nature disaster. But actually, everyone knows there's no nature disaster at all. Many people died of the hunger that time. But now in China history, the history book, or even in the mainstream media still say, oh, it's a nature disaster. It's not a human, a political mistake, or even political crime.
If we talk about the Great Famine that started in 1959 and lasted until 1961, and during that famine, probably 30 million people perished. 30 million people disappeared from the demographic record. And as for that, overseas, you have several books, but there is not a single book in China directly addressing the issue of famine and how it happened. So the Great Famine is still a taboo in history learning.
My name is Qin Chen. You know, I'm born in 1980s, so I don't know much about what happened to the China. When my parents told me about the story, they don't have enough food. So we can't believe it. I can't imagine it.
Why didn't you know about it?
The history I focus on the ancient China and not, you know, the teacher will told you about the Cultural Revolution, but very seldom.
Qin Cheng is studying for an MA in journalism at one of Beijing's leading universities. Even in this relatively open time, for her generation and for people in their 30s and 40s, the stories of the Great Leap Forward and its famine, of the Cultural Revolution with its vast public trauma and estimated 10 million dead, or of the violence and passion of China's repeated pro-democracy protests, remain obscure and puzzling.
If you look at our history book, it's all about the ancient China, the Han Dynasty, Tang Dynasty, and a very powerful dynasty. Yeah. For us, if we go to the museum, we want to know the story. But, you know, in Chinese museum, they have the exhibition. They also show how the valuable the object is.
So it's all about valuable objects and not about the story.
Yeah. I think it's a problem for me. You know, nowadays the young generation know about the sensitive history from the internet.
So 1979, democracy wall?
I think I know.
And 1989?
I think I know, but, you know, it's very hard to say.
So while Japanese atrocities are played up, Chinese atrocities are hushed up. The internal traumas of the last 60 years are unacknowledged or brushed aside in the officially sanctioned narratives. They exist only in private memories and family secrets, conditioning the behaviour and feelings of hundreds of millions of people. Lin Gu, again.
I have my own cousins who were sent to the countryside answering Chairman Mao's call to be re-educated in the countryside. And they do have their own bitter history to be buried deep side down in their own hearts. I have urged repeatedly my cousins to speak out, to even write some, or to have some oral history of what happened there, because I think if it's possible for Cultural Revolution to be forgotten, especially by young Chinese minds, so it's their duty, historical duty, to write down what they experienced themselves. My mom, nowadays, when somebody knock at our family door heavily, she could easily get very, very nervous. And that was the legacy of Cultural Revolution, because in those days, her family house was easily robbed and ransacked by Red Guards.
You can come across China's hidden history in really quite unexpected places. There is no museum to the 10 years of chaos of the Cultural Revolution, but here in the Police Museum in Beijing, just south of Tiananmen Square, there are some interesting clues. This isn't somewhere you'd expect to find a story of persecution told from the victim's point of view. Most of the displays here tell you how the state kept its criminals firmly in line throughout China's history. But in the Cultural Revolution, even the police became victims in what they now describe as a national catastrophe. As the displays illustrate, nearly 1,000 police were sent to reform through labour, nearly 10,000 were dismissed, and more than 100, including some very senior figures indeed, were persecuted to death. This is not a museum for the squeamish. Today, China's building more museums, bigger and faster than any country on earth. There are big architectural statements in the major cities that announce that China's competing on the world cultural stage. And in obscure county towns, officials are building museums to attract tourists. The Cultural Revolution is recreated as a kitsch theme in restaurants and karaoke bars. But few of China's new museums tackle the hidden history that so many citizens carry in their memories and that they re-encounter as they go about their daily lives. Antonia Finane is a historian living in Beijing who's recently written a history of China through dress.
Down the end of this street, where we are sitting now talking, down the end of this very street is the Workers' Stadium, which is used to hold soccer matches. There was an article recently about a young man whose name is quite well known as someone who died during the Cultural Revolution. His name was Yu Luoke. Yu Luoke was the child of people who were convicted of rightism in the anti-rightist campaign of 1957. Over 3 million people in China were convicted of that crime. During the Cultural Revolution, he wrote some stinging critiques of the whole practice of class struggle in its effects on someone like him, who had been a child at the time of liberation and could not possibly be guilty of rightist crimes. He was finally arrested and, with 18 others, I think, executed in front of a mass crowd in the Workers' Stadium. After his mother died, the surviving children found in her diary a reference to walking past the Workers' Stadium and how every time she walked past it, she would turn her head away so not to look. It just made me feel must be an enormous number of people in Beijing still walking around with this sense of places that they would rather never have been and the things that happened there.
In a tranquil Beijing park, where once the emperors came to pray for good harvests, groups of men and women in their 50s and 60s gather for a communal song session. They clearly love it, belting out their favourites from song sheets handed out on the spot. Many of the songs are versions of Tibetan or Mongolian folk songs. Others are the songs of their own youth. This is the Cultural Revolution generation. And whatever their individual memories, the music of that extraordinary time still seems to bind them together in the memory of a shared experience. Singing is one thing, but telling the story of the Cultural Revolution is quite another. To find the Cultural Revolution in extraordinary detail, I had to leave the silences or the veiled references in China's official museums and go far from the cities to the depths of rural Sichuan, to Fanzhenchuan's extraordinary museum cluster. It would be remarkable anywhere. In China, it's truly extraordinary. Here, in this millionaire's private passion, there are tens of millions of objects and documents, some unique, many mundane objects of everyday use that collectively add up to the most complete picture in China of daily life in the Cultural Revolution. And here on the wall of the museum, there's a blown-up black-and-white image of a young soldier in heroic pose. He's gazing at the horizon, determined to repel his country's enemies. It's reminiscent of 1,000 classic propaganda posters, but it's actually a photograph of the museum's founder, Fanzhenchuan, who at the age of 19 found himself serving in Inner Mongolia, one of the first lines of defence for the People's Liberation Army against a feared Soviet invasion. Mr. Fan told me he's always been a collector of ephemera, right from the time when, as a boy, he saved his first school reports. 40 years later, he's tens of millions of objects hoarded, and more come in every day. He houses a fraction of them in the 15 museums he's already built and plans to open a dozen more. They're all designed by celebrated architects and their subjects are diverse. The story of US assistance to China in World War II, for example, or the treatment of Chinese prisoners of war by Japan. Within a month of the 2008 Sichuan earthquake, he'd opened a museum dedicated to the event. He has millions of pieces of Mao memorabilia, from badges to teapots and posters. He has private letters and diaries, newspapers, photographs. I asked him how he'd come by the hundreds of framed marriage certificates from the 60s and 70s. Most of China's moved house in the last 30 years, he said,
things get thrown out. But even the extraordinary Mr. Fan has to curb his enthusiasm when faced with official restrictions. He's not been allowed to open a planned Great Leap Forward museum, and his three museums dedicated to the Cultural Revolution are called, rather more neutrally, the Museums of the Red Age.
It was difficult for me to do this. I am the only person in China who is doing this, and I have had to be really cautious about it. I had to make compromises with the local government, for example. I promised them not to build any museum about the armed struggle or about the problem of suicides during the Cultural Revolution time. I simply could not work on these types of museums at the moment. The local government and the central government certainly would not permit it. And I suppose that I don't allow myself to try and establish such material. So at present I am preparing new museums on the re-educated youth and a ticket and certificate museum. And of course, I will need government permission before being allowed to open.
This is one of three museums in this site dedicated to the Cultural Revolution, and it powerfully takes me back to the times of upheaval and deep austerity in the early 70s when I was living in China as a student. There's the heroic music played over the loudspeakers and their background to this extraordinary collection of found objects and recreations of life, which come in vivid and detailed tableau. Every object of daily life carries a slogan, a political message, and to buy anything, from food to essential cotton, you needed coupons, which are also on display. Even human urine and excrement were subject to a coupon regime. They were used as fertilizer, and they were covered by official rules, they were rationed, and there was punishment if you didn't deliver. For a foreign visitor accustomed to the open discussion of history, it's perhaps hard to appreciate the significance of Mr. Fan's passion to document some of the cruelest episodes of China's recent past. His museums are creating waves in China for the way they've pushed back against official silence. There were not many customers when I visited in a chilly midwinter week, and perhaps for good reason the museum is off the beaten track. Even the charismatic Mr. Fan, who made his millions in property development and who once served as a city mayor, is careful not to push too hard. As in the official museums, the objects are left to tell the story. The messages are coded in displays if you know how to read the code. In one, for instance, a series of New Year newspaper front pages documents the growth of Mao's dangerous personality cult. But why does Mr. Fan think it's so difficult openly to discuss China's recent past?
Actually, I don't think this is a problem just in China. America has not got a museum to the attacks on September 11th, for example. Out of consideration for security, and especially the security of a dictatorship, it's normal for central government to consider this. I don't want to disturb the calm that people might feel. The Cultural Revolution is too close to today, and people who killed others and beat people during this time are still alive. They are mostly aged between 55 and 65. What I might do could influence their rights and impact on their lives, and I really don't want to do that. We must learn from this history, but I don't want my museum to disturb the social order. We cannot face another revolution. I don't want to see more demonstrations. I don't want to see more bloodshed. All of this has been witnessed during the Cultural Revolution, and I don't want to see it again today. I have seen the suffering, and I do not want to see it anymore.
On this open terrace, there's a series of large glass rectangles covered with 2,000 red handprints that look as though they've been printed in blood, though actually it's paint. These are the hands of the Chinese veterans of the War of Resistance against Japan from 1937 to 1945. And nearby, in another part of this museum complex, there's the story of those who didn't survive, the many, many thousands of Chinese prisoners taken by the Japanese and enslaved or murdered by their captors. Grim images of Japanese soldiers beheading them, bayoneting them. It's a powerful and it's a moving display,
but it also speaks to a continuing anger and a sense of past crimes that still burns in the Chinese memory. If Chinese atrocities are difficult to discuss, the crimes of other nations against China are documented everywhere. In particular, as China's economic power has grown to challenge that of Japan for preeminence in Asia, so have the museums dedicated to the Japanese occupation of China and the atrocities committed. Museums like the Nanjing Memorial Museum are China's equivalent of Western Holocaust museums, and they're part of Mr. Fan's story too. One of his favourite objects, he told me, is a white cloth given by a father to his son to be used either as a bandage if he was wounded by the Japanese, or in the event of worse, as a shroud. It's all told as a patriotic epic in which China heroically resisted Japan. Chiang Kai-shek, once airbrushed out of the anti-Japanese war, is now given his due. But the role of the United States or other nations in Japan's defeat is barely mentioned. And there is a dark side in many personal memories too. The anthropologist Jing Jun.
My mother never told me that she had a brother until a few years ago. She said, I'm old, I'm going to die pretty soon, and you need to know this. The other brother of mine used to work for the Japanese, and he was executed when the Japanese left. And executed in a very bad way. His flesh was cut off by Caesars. And the other brother of my mother got his body and buried him in a secret site. And today, even his tomb is unmarked. It's this kind of history to not get told until the people who know the history very, you know, firsthand feel that they need to tell their children about certain things. So this is came very shocking.
When I first came here in the 1970s, this was largely farmland. There were just a few odd Baroque ruins poking up through the undergrowth. But to find them, you had to go down a little country lane, and nobody really came here. This is the Yuanmingyuan in northwest Beijing, the round, bright garden, one of the most celebrated gardens in Asia in its day. The Qing emperors built it over several centuries, and it contained, amongst other things, a Baroque palace designed by an Italian artist and a French missionary. It was a French army, along with the British, who destroyed it in 1860. And today, the park is being restored and the ruins have been excavated as a historic site with an explanatory message about this moment of national humiliation. Even on this cold winter's day, there's a steady stream of visitors going round. And the lesson they're being taught is that when China is weak, foreign forces will try to destroy it. But these public lessons and the dangers of national weakness and humiliation, currently aimed at the Japanese, are a recent phenomenon, part of China's contemporary nation-building that aims to build patriotism and unity in this huge and highly diverse country. It's not how museums in China started out. China's first native museum was opened in 1905 in central China by a modernising industrialist, Dr. Zhang Jie, who wanted to help push China into a modern scientific age. He couldn't persuade the government to do it, so he did it himself, and he dedicated it to the things China most needed, science and technology. China's most famous museum today is the Forbidden City, the former palace of the Qing and Ming emperors in Beijing. But that didn't open to the public until 1924, and the greater part of the collection was taken to Taiwan in 1949 by the losing side in the Civil War. That year, at the birth of New China, there were just 21 museums in the whole country. But as the communist regime set about transforming China into their vision of socialist paradise, museums were to play a key role. By the end of the 1950s, the 21 museums had become 500. Antonia Fenane.
One of the ways in which the 10th anniversary of 1949 was commemorated was by the completion of these 10 great buildings which were going to mark Beijing as the capital of the new China. And a number of these buildings were museums, Cultural Palace of the Nationalities, Military Museum, the National Art Gallery, and most important, the National History Museum, which was on Tiananmen Square itself. Their frontages were maximized. They all present as monumental buildings, and that was particularly important in the case of the National Museum, which faced the Great Hall of the People. But all the buildings were very shallow, as though what was going inside them wasn't going to be nearly as important as what people walking along outside would see. This takes us to the point about the iconic importance of museums in a cityscape. Their presence was more important than their function.
In the early days of the revolution, communist historians were clear about the correct Marxist version of history. But today, China's National Museum of History, closed for renovation and due to reopen for the 2008 Olympics, is still closed. Are China's historians less sure today of what story they should be telling? As Wang Hui explains, in the early days, it was just a matter of following Karl Marx and the Soviet example.
If you had the experience in the historic museum and the revolutionary museum, basically you have the more or less the Marxist narrative of history, started from primitive society, slavery, and feudal, and so on and so forth, and then the revolution, capitalism. That is the five social formations came from the Stalinist dogma.
The Chinese government may have changed the terminology, but its interest in the power of history remains. 30 years ago, historians knew they had to describe the so-called feudal past as dark and oppressive. Traditions were rejected, and China's imperial history deemed just a prelude to the revolution. But now the official story celebrates China's long history. In fact, it stretches it in both time and space, rather further than the evidence will bear. As much as 5,000 years and subsuming the widest possible territory. An image of unchanging China, as doubtful in reality as the Soviet-style narrative was, has been pressed into service to the great discomfort of many of China's non-Han Chinese citizens, who find this version of history in conflict with their own narratives. Historians David Kelly and then Thomas Bartlett explain.
It's currently embarrassing to mention that the previous great dynasty, the Qing dynasty, was a dynasty of invaders, an invading ethnic group, the Manchus, people who were not Han Chinese. Nowadays it has to be reconfigured, so that we see the Qing dynasty as a part of the greater Chinese people incorporating another part of the greater Chinese people.
I wonder if it's an expression of anxiety, sort of modernization shock. I mean, China is clearly so different in so many daily invasive ways for everyone than it was a mere half century ago. It may be a reflexive statement, a kind of, you know, scratching myself saying, yes, underneath it all, I am Chinese. And certainly I don't mean to ridicule that reaction, because it's been done in many places, cultures which have striven to establish a nation state. It's a kind of textual or historical fundamentalism.
When I first came to China, halfway through the Cultural Revolution, almost every museum in the country was closed. History was something to be smashed, denounced, or transcended. But in another 5 years, China aims to have some 3,000 museums, each trying to claim public attention. Many of the new museums are powerfully effective. The Earthquake Museum, one of Fan Jianchuan's museums in Sichuan, is a deeply moving display of lives shattered by natural disaster. And though it doesn't spell out the other message, the corruption that left children to die in badly built schools, the implication is nevertheless strongly felt.
As you walk into the Earthquake Museum, it's like coming into a shattered building. The place itself feels broken. There are broken beams and fallen masonry, and the floor's uneven, just to make it feel a bit dangerous. But it's not just a reconstruction of the Wenchuan earthquake of 2008. What makes it powerful are, of course, the photographs of the victims and their rescuers, but more the objects of daily life that were salvaged from the homes and the schools. I can see school bags, I can see children's gloves, diaries, papers. There's everything from Premier Wen Jiabao's loud hailer to a dead child's last essay. What's amazing is that this museum was opened within a month of the earthquake as a quite terrifying memorial to the power of nature and the fragility of human life. I can think of no other country on earth where such a collection could have been put together and displayed in such a short time. One of the defining images of that time was of a man on a motorbike, his dead wife strapped on his back as he took her home for burial. And here, in front of that blown-up image, is the bike itself. You can find museums devoted to almost anything in China today, from pianos to espionage. There's a new spy museum in Nanjing that bans foreigners in case they expose state secrets. But what sort of message will any of these new museums put out about the great yawning gaps in China's 20th century history? Will they encourage an honest understanding of the past, or are they still at the service of a government that now wants to portray China as strong and powerful in a hostile world? A nationalist message that has uneasy echoes of other rising powers in the past. Despite the efforts of brave entrepreneurs like Mr. Fan, who says he's already left his museum to the nation, the government continues to control history and the stories it tells. As Zhao Mu testifies, the weekly lists of banned topics still circulate to editors.
Yes, they do have. They do have many, many. But it's already changed for this week, for that week. Particularly that message, that order come from the Department of Propaganda of the Communist Party. They never told that list in a written way, usually from telephone calling to the editor-in-chief.
So there's no paper trail for the list?
Usually, no.
One of the Cultural Revolution's most celebrated and tragic victims was the writer Lao Shi, one of the best-loved writers of 20th century China. He lived here in this courtyard house off a very narrow alley in central Beijing. It's very quiet, it's very peaceful. And Lao Shi wrote about the life in these alleys, most of them now gone. This museum tells everything you want to know about his life. It's surrounded by his objects of everyday use, his study, his bedroom, and pictures of his family. But the one thing it doesn't tell you is how he died. On August 23rd, 1966, Red Guards came here. They dragged him out, beat him, and humiliated him in public. And the next day, as far as the official story now goes, he drowned himself. But the only clue here as to what happened in those terrible days in August 1966 is a calendar left open at the page of August 24th, the day he died, on his desk in his study. And so a nation that prides itself on its long and diverse history still receives its modern history in dissociated fragments. Some come through family memoirs, others through the power of objects and places, some from the internet or transmitted by enlightened professors in a few universities. The teaching and presentation of history has changed, but many historians and thinkers are frustrated with the continuing restrictions on the exploration of the past. How, they ask, can China become a modern, open society if it can't tell the truth about its own past? The eminent 82-year-old economist Mao Yushi and Professor Zhao Mu, but first the historian Wang Hui.
I think that the omission of 20th century is one of the phenomena of historiography. What's the real rupture happened in that period is one of the most crucial questions for us. What really happened?
It seems that most of China, the government, the ordinary people, they don't care about history. Most of people, China as a whole, they care about the economy, growth, the money, materialism, consumptionism. If you cannot get a very good lesson from history, that makes the history always go like a circle. So the mistake, again, a mistake.
They continued Mao Zedong's regime. They have to cover what Mao Zedong did. In fact, the people know the history. The number of people is getting more and more. You cannot cover a history at a long time and for the majority of people. China become a harmonic and a stable country should based on truth, not based on lie. Yeah.
China's museum building boom was presented by Isabel Hilton and produced by Anthony Denslow. Tomorrow, Isabel marks the 100th anniversary of the fall of the Qing dynasty. What does this moment mean to China? Join Isabel for In the Shadow of the Emperor tomorrow evening at 9:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
Friday night at the BBC Proms and a complete concert performance of Benjamin Britten's searing psychological drama, Peter Grimes.
Look, now's our chance. The whole sea's boiling. Get the nets. Come, boy.
A work that established a new tradition in English opera and an acclaimed ENO production that's been playing to packed houses since 2009.
We're going to see.
Britten's Peter Grimes from the BBC Proms. Friday night on BBC Radio 3 from 7 o'clock.
Time now for tonight's essay. This week, writers reminisce about their travels across Europe with the Interrail Pass, which recently celebrated its 40th birthday. This evening, it's the turn of the Sri Lankan-born writer Rema Tian to read her Interrail postcard.
Though I didn't know it at the time, this would be my last complete moment of freedom for 30 years. And even then, getting my Interrail pass wasn't easy. For this was the 1970s, and my Sri Lankan parents were horrified to think their only daughter was planning to travel to Europe alone. A chaperone, they said firmly, was essential. And, like a rabbit being pulled out of a hat, a distant cousin was called upon. I was not pleased. Her name, for the purpose of this narrative at least, was Sunitra. And while I was busily poring over maps of Europe, Sunitra made lists of the dangers that lay in wait for us. Station toilets featured high on that list. Train travel had been part of my journey to and from school in Sri Lanka, pulled by steam engines that hugged the coastline from Mount Lavinia to Colombo. We had also gone, my parents and I, on the narrow gauge night sleeper to Norelia. And perhaps it was this trip, more than any other, that made me feel train travel spelt adventure. A journey across France, through Switzerland, and all the way down to the south of Italy. That was the plan. We began in the early hours of darkness on a boat train that left Victoria for the coast. My mother and father and various maiden aunts came to see us off, and it was clear from their expressions of disapproval that they felt my parents were being too lenient with me. We found our reserved seats and the sending-off party boarded the train. Inevitably, the aunts had bought parcels of food. Scowling, I pointed out we weren't going across the desert, but they insisted, and we were forced to take their Tupperware containers of fried rice and curry. I didn't want home cooking. I wanted to try out the local food from the places we visited, bought on the hoof, eaten that way too. But my family, still traumatized by our move to Britain a decade earlier, had lost all interest in foreign travel. My own expectations of this trip were not without oddities. These were a mixture of high youthful romance and improbable luggage. I'd been watching Roman Holiday, which, although nothing to do with trains, was all about glamour, escape and freedom. Unlike the backpackers who soon filled our compartments, I carried an old-fashioned suitcase covered in exotic labels from the places we had passed on our voyage to England. I say passed because apart from brief stops at the ports of Naples and Genoa, I had not set foot in Europe before. From Dover, we followed a crescent moon floating on a darkened sea, and somewhere around midnight we crossed the invisible line that took us into French waters. Then, in the early hours of the morning, we boarded our first foreign train. I remember I had two books with me. One was William Maxwell's The Chateau, a book about a visit to France after the war, and the other, Fair Stood the Wind for France by H.E. Bates, a novel about escape from wartime France. I was curious to see what shadows remained in a country once occupied by force. In Fares to the Wind for France, an injured RAF pilot tries desperately to cross enemy territories on a train filled with German soldiers. As Sunitra settled down in our 6-bunk couchette, I lay thinking of that pilot and the French girl who had fallen in love with him. Sleep was impossible. Eventually, unable to contain my excitement, I crept out of my bunk and opened the door into the corridor. The moon now threaded its way through a rush of trees. The air was fresh and cool, and occasionally we would pass a sleeping town where deserted streets were bathed in orange light. But mostly, the darkness was filled with fields. A boy, about my age, stood smoking against the open window. He glanced at me and nodded. "Where are you going?" he asked in an accent that surely spelt drama and excitement. As I opened my mouth to reply, the door of my compartment slid open and Sunitra's head appeared. In a shocked whisper, she asked me to come back to my bunk. "It's okay," the boy told her, making matters worse. "She comes out to smoke." Furious, I was forced to return. Sunitra settled down again, satisfied, the pleated folds of her sari trailing on the ground, a bottle of Dettol clutched in her hand. Arriving by train into the heart of any city, one is confronted by the neglected side of urban life, with high-rise humanity all squashed together. That day was no different. But on that day, arriving for the very first time, with all my life before me, even the greyish railway dust of the Gare du Nord was exciting. Many years later, as I sit on the Eurostar, in a compartment crowded with business travellers, their heads bent towards laptop screens, their mobile phones bleeping a network change, I still remember the wonder of that first moment. And I cannot help but look up at the approaching city and see my younger self. That morning, as crumpled and unwashed we stepped off our train, it was the smell of coffee that assailed me first. Coffee and the beginnings of my life as a writer. Sunitra headed for what she assured me was the cleanest loos in Paris. Breakfast followed. I was seeing a Paris that today I struggled to find. Then, I remember, water was brought to the table in an odd shape Ricard bottle. The waiters refused to speak in English. The posters in the metro repeated themselves in multiples of 6. Today, that Paris of the 1970s, like everywhere else in Europe, has succumbed to global change, and although the waiters still prefer to speak French, American English, and the long arm of homogeneity is everywhere. We stayed in Paris for just over a week, engaged in tedious visits to relatives working at the Sri Lankan embassy. I was desperate to escape. This was not how I had imagined my Interrail trip. Time, I decided, to break out and move on to Italy. Our train to Milan would leave from Gare de l'Est. Cunningly, I sent Sunitra to the Gare du Nord, telling her I would meet her there. It was a plan not without difficulties, but I convinced her I needed to take some last-minute photographs, and as mornings were not her best time, she agreed to join me at the station. Years before, I had mastered the art of giving authority the slip, when, aged 10, I defied my long-suffering mother and crept ashore in Aden. Only after the alarm was raised by her was I found and brought back aboard ship to be severely reprimanded. By comparison, getting rid of Sunitra was easy. She was, I suspect, already regretting her role as my chaperone, and so, on that last morning in Paris, with a cheery wave in her direction, I strolled out of the hotel. At the Gare de l'Est, I breakfasted on croissants and attempted a few faltering words. Then I bought my first copy of French Vogue, before going in search of my train, only to discover the peculiar pleasure of the Continental Departure Board. Here were names both unfamiliar and recognisable, each filled with possibilities that I could spend the rest of my life chasing. I had not understood until that moment how large Europe really was. I was due to cross two borders, one into Switzerland and almost immediately another into Italy. After that, I planned to travel down to Rome on a fast train from Milan via Turin. I stamped my ticket. In those days, I was travelling on a Sri Lankan passport and therefore had to secure transit visas for each country. At midday, I bought a picnic of strange cheeses with unpronounceable names and some bread. By evening, I would be in Turin. Belatedly and rather reluctantly, I remembered I needed to ring my parents and tell them that Sunitra and I had parted company and that I intended to finish the rest of the trip alone. When they objected, I would simply run out of francs for the phone. My last words would be that I would send them a postcard from Naples. Now my trip took on an entirely different texture. Looking back, I don't remember every detail, but the main substance, the joy, the sheer sense of freedom of that first time has never left me. Other journeys taken over the years, with my husband, with our children, work-related trips, have all had their individual charm, of course. But the memories from that single interrail adventure have a special quality of their own. On that September day, after leaving Sunitra, I discovered what it meant to cross a real border. Now, as I travel from one European city to another, the distinctions are merely symbolic boundaries. But back then, in the 70s, the border was simultaneously more complicated, yet less terrifying. It was something substantial, of which, as you passed, you might say, "Yes, I have arrived, and what an enigma it all is." It was late afternoon when we passed through the apple orchards of France and on towards the Alps, snowless and leathery as an elephant's back, before slipping into yet another tunnel. As the landmass changed, so too did the style of the villages. In the alpine sunlight, a woman wearing a red headscarf straightened up in a field to watch our train, as she would have done at the same time yesterday, as she would again tomorrow. I felt very far from home, a traveller in an unutterably foreign land. My border trouble didn't begin until Turin. At the station, a police officer met the train, and I and my passport were taken off. Moments later, I was in an interview room. It seemed the problem was my entry visa. Half an hour, and I was still waiting. But now I had a different worry. When I had seen the policeman board the train, I had panicked and stuffed my cash into a bread roll which I had then deposited in the waste paper bin under the window beside my seat. This wasn't as crazy as it sounds. Sunitra had told me we could only take a certain amount of French francs into Italy. Having no idea what that amount was, I had decided to play safe and hide everything. The bin in my compartment now held all my money. And my worry was that someone would have seen what I had done and taken it. Or else the train would leave without me. Either ways, I would be penniless. But luck was on my side, and after some cursory questions and a piercing look at my guilty face, the immigration officer waved me back onto the train. Today, of course, borders are created less by geographical boundaries than by mental anxieties. In the light of international terror, my first border crossing appears as innocence lost, a simple adventure in foreignness. Today, that moment of entry, where language and currency changes with landscape, has largely vanished. It is a small thing, this otherness, but like all good travel, it helped expand the mind, making us more conscious of differences. I felt it acutely once, but now, although our globalized lives allow us to travel as never before, our sense of the exotic has begun to fade, and we are losing those subtle distinctions of time and place. Sometimes, when I am feeling nostalgic for the past, I look for it in the second-hand bookshops scattered around England. I find it there in the tattered guidebooks of the 1970s, with their boundaries marked on fragile rice paper maps. Places where, long ago when I was young, an old woman had time to stand and watch the daily rite of a train passing from one country to another.
That was Roma Tierne with her Interrail postcard. And on Thursday evening, the writer Charlotte Mendelssohn poignantly explores the reasons why travel didn't broaden her young and fearful mind when she set off across Europe with four friends in the early 1990s.
Children are naturally curious, and schools too often kill and blunt curiosity, partly because of the obsession with exams.
What should our schools teach?
Dance, drama, music, we find difficult to measure. And because politicians don't ask for them to be measured, lots of schools get the message that they're not valued.
A new series looks at fundamental questions in education.
We've just got to change the language, stop using vocational as if we mean not very bright, and actually make that a really valued part of our national curriculum.
The education debates begin on BBC Radio 4, tomorrow night at 8.
This is BBC Radio 3, and the time is now 11 o'clock. Time to visit the Edinburgh Festival for the first of three live Late Junction programmes. So from the Blue Tent at the BBC's own venue at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, here's Verity Sharp.
Very blue here indeed. Thanks, Ian. In fact, people are sporting blue scarves. More about that later. Welcome to Edinburgh. The city, as you can imagine at this time of year, is literally teeming with performers. You can't go more than 10 paces along a street before bumping into a juggler or a busker or a street artist. And the creative spirit here is almost palpable. The BBC has its own fringe venue. This month, there's been a whole host of comedy and theatre here. And tonight, of course, we've got a whole variety of music. The audience are gathered beneath a beautiful canopy of twinkling fairy lights. And we have three groups of musicians on stage waiting to deliver a magical evening of music for this special edition of Late Junction. All the way from Belgium and fresh from their concerts for the main Edinburgh International Festival, we have the world-renowned viol ensemble, the Richikar Ensemble. And then over on the far side of the stage, we have three consummate musicians sitting in a row. Chris Drever is in the middle, Eamon Coyne on the banjo on the far right, and then Megan Henderson. And they are the Chris Drever Trio. And then lining the back of the stage, dressed in the rich colours of the traditional Mongolian dress, we have the six players of Anda Union. And true to Late Junction style, we like to mix things up on this programme, as I'm sure you all know. So we're going to start by hearing all three groups playing back to back. And to start us off, we have a song called Delcha from Anda Union.
Hey,
شمادري جنجر عجيزك وطني يأسر حرمس ورغجي حير دو غرغلوي حنشن دو خاجنجي حور يا يا هون بكري نورتن دو ورغجي
ورغ دو غرغلوي يمبر برخن الجلوة غلو دسخيل خني يمبر هان بكتوا ورغ دو غرغلوي يمبر برخن الجلوة
Show